true poem, Walt Whitman proclaimed in 1852, should be as realistic as the daily newspaper. Like a blast of cold air in a stuffy drawing room, Whitman's campaign to give artistic representation to gritty realities shocked the genteel artistic elite of the 1850s. But the brassy poet's efforts helped generate a revolution in American life and thought. 4 decades later, Willa Cather could declare that the public demands realism, and they will have it.
Historian David Shine, he's here to talk about his new book, Facing Facts, an account of realism in American thought and culture between 1850 and 1920. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. The poetry of Walt Whitman, the local color of Louisa May Alcott and Sarah Orne Jewett, the novels of Henry James, and the painting of Thomas Aiken. These are examples of American realism, a sweeping cultural movement that began early in the 19th century and carries into the present. Underscoring the rise of science, the growth of capitalism, and the expansion of our cities, in both art and politics, realism reflected profound changes in American society, especially in the years from before the Civil War through America's emergence as an international power after World War I. In his new book, historian David Shine provides a comprehensive account of the realist impulse in American society. The book is entitled Facing Facts, Realism in American Thought and Culture, 1850 to 1920. David Shine is president of Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina.
Realism was a widespread movement in thought and the arts that swept across Western Europe and the United States, beginning in the early 19th century and coalescing in America in the 1850s, in the decade before the Civil War. It was a movement of conscious rebellion and reaction against the prevailing forms of cultural idealism that then dominated American thought and the arts. And so, in part, this was a rebellion against the status quo.
Now, we attach to a word like idealism another word like sentimentality or sentimentalism, feeling rather than being, and being tough-minded out there in the world. When we talk of words like realism in everyday lingo, oh, we say get real, get realistic. I want you to pursue that, contrast for me between the ideal and the real.
Yes, indeed. In fact, realism emerged in part because of a sense that American thought and culture was not keeping up with a changing social world and environment. There was a sense that the people who controlled the newspapers, controlled the journals and periodicals in which short stories were published, controlled the art museums and aesthetic taste, were brittle, were too genteel, were ashamed of contemporary reality and preferred to deal with topics in the distant past or the exotic imagination, the romantic imagination, if you will. So there was an explicit rebellion among the realists against what they perceived to be the anachronistic emphases of idealism and sentimentalism especially.
Well, that's an interesting confluence that realism would find a place in America at a time when the United States was becoming, again, the United States. I mean, here in the wake of the Civil War, I take it that there was a kind of political dimension at work in bringing the forces of realism to the fore in our country.
Well, one of my primary objectives in writing this book was to try to delineate the factors that converged at the middle of the 19th century and then for the next 50 years or so to spawn this perceptible shift in cultural style and sensibility.
Here we go back to a movement against idealism and into realism.
Yes, but what made this movement appear in the middle of the century? Obviously, there were tremors earlier, and in fact, realism emerges first as a self-conscious movement in Europe in the 1820s and 30s, but by the 1850s in the United States, it was coalescing in America. And it involved several factors. One of the most important was the emergence of a new scientific spirit, much more ruthless in its preoccupation with objective facts.
Right.
In fact, it was during the 1830s that those people who typically investigated the natural world began to be called scientists as opposed to being called natural philosophers.
Well, we think about Darwin comes along, what, in 1859? But he has their people before him doing work and putting out the groundwork here.
Very much so. In fact, strewn throughout the magazines and the periodicals and the diaries and journals of intellectuals during the 1840s and 1850s are references to the mania for facts that was sweeping across American thought and college life. And this preoccupation with the empirical, with the verifiable, with what can be seen and tested swept across not only the sciences, the physical sciences, but soon affected the social sciences. A discipline like history, for example, decided that it wanted to become scientific and deal just with the facts as known and as could be discovered. So this scientific impulse toward the facts and the visual or the visible realities of life was a very important factor. Another factor involved the emergence of two important new media. The newspaper, the modern metropolitan newspaper, and photography. Mm-hmm. Both of these media appeared about the same time, the 1840s. The so-called penny press democratized the newspapers so that the masses now had access to newspapers. And in order to attract a mass audience, more and more editors decided to focus their newspapers instead of on ethereal political discussion to focus on the everyday events and the crimes and the circumstances of daily life.
Well, the newspapers became, I think you used the word mirror. They held up a mirror to the circumstances of life in the United States, especially in the cities. That's an important ingredient, is it not?
Yes. In fact, realism, both in Europe and the United States, was very much an urban phenomenon, in part because the dramatic rise of a city culture, a cosmopolitan sensibility, involved people mixing and mingling in their daily lives and seeing one another, observing one another on the sidewalks or from the balconies or in a streetcar. Uh-huh. In other words, it was much more appropriate during America's rural and pastoral stage of development for there to be a primarily idealist sensibility, such as exemplified in Emerson and Thoreau and the Transcendentalist. But as America became more and more urban, understandably, people wanted to have the everyday realities of their city life expressed in poetry, in fiction, and in art.
Mm-hmm. David Shai, again, your book is Facing Facts. It's an account of realism in American thought and culture. Early in our conversation, you used the word movement. Now, let me be contentious with you, David. Cultural historians, as I understand it, you should be suspicious of assigning a single word like that to something that is so complicated, that takes so many manifestations. How is it that you can call realism a movement if it has so many ingredients? It's not monolithic, after all, is it?
No, and it was, although it was a very potent force in American thought during the 19th century, it was not omnipotent. It was not omnipotent. It did not monopolize American thought, but it certainly was in the forefront of cultural debate and discussion during the 19th century.
Was it a word that was used as such during the 19th century?
It was used ubiquitously, and people quite self-consciously began to label one another realist or idealist, or realist versus sentimentalist, or realist versus romantics. So it definitely took on the form of a movement, and people were perceived as the leaders of the movement, people such as Henry James and William Dean Howells, Winslow Homer in art, Thomas Aikens in painting, Louis Sullivan in the realm of architecture. He too began to be labeled a realist.
Let's talk about some of the artistic expressions of realism. Here you've just ticked off a list of names. I think of that wonderful novel Moby Dick and that marvelous Captain Ahab saying that he's going to strike through the pasteboard mask of reality. Am I making a connection here that's inappropriate?
No, it's a very valid connection. In fact, Moby Dick is a very good example of a work of literature that straddles two types of literary perspective, one being the romantic, the desire to explore the hidden and metaphysical realm of human endeavor, and the other being realistic. You may remember from reading Moby Dick that there are densely detailed passages describing the scientific behavior of whales and
cetology.
Fishing industry.
Cetology.
Cetology, that's right, a whole field of scientific inquiry. So a book like that is a masterpiece in part because it so effectively integrates different forms of literary sensibility, the romantic and the realistic, the metaphysical and the scientific.
Now, I also think of the name Mark Twain as a wonderful example of realism. Does the fact that Mark Twain was, how should we put this, initially a sort of comic writer, that is to say the comic spirit, and then at the end of his life he becomes very pessimistic, mm-hmm. does that bear on his connection? In what way does that bear on his connection to realism?
Well, not surprisingly, Mark Twain is a very slippery character to pigeonhole in any single classification. In fact, I've found no instance where he himself referred to his writing as realistic, although it had many manifestations that we associate with literary realism, such as his preoccupation with writing dialect as accurately as possible in order to convey the distinctive way in which people express themselves orally. Mm-hmm. Mark Twain, in part, his stature, his greatness, is because he was able to integrate different modes of literary creativity, such as Melville was able to do. That is, he's romantic and he's realistic simultaneously.
One of Mark Twain's wonderful themes is race and racial harmony. He is, even in the 1990s, accused of being a racist because he uses language which is politically incorrect, mm-hmm. inappropriate in some circles, and certainly something that makes us uncomfortable. How do we connect a theme like race to the realistic movement?
Well, one of the major themes or emphases within the realistic movement was an effort to democratize literature. What I mean by that
is... Here we go back to the newspapers after a fashion.
Yes, in the same sense that the newspapers began to cover the activities of the working classes and common folk, so too did writers such as Mark Twain and William Dean Howells and others self-consciously begin to include characters from the whole spectrum of American society. Mm-hmm. That is, rich and poor, working class, the rich, the wealthy, the corporate leaders, but also blacks, Native Americans, immigrants mm-hmm. began to appear in fiction for the first time. And Twain was one of those who took the lead in integrating within his short stories characters who heretofore were kept out mm-hmm. of serious literature.
What about the question of gender? I recall, you're going to have to help me here, David, is it Stephen Crane who wrote the book about the prostitute? Maggie.
Yes.
We're looking again at an element, at an underside of American culture, and we're looking at it sort of clear and mm-hmm. cold-eyed here in realistic terms. How about that?
One of the recurring emphases of my treatment of realism is the importance of what I call a gender dynamic that is interwoven in the development of thought and the arts throughout the 19th century. Part of the appeal of realism for both men and women was that it was such a self-conscious reaction against what people perceived to have become an overly feminine cultural form of expression mm-hmm. and the dangers of an increasingly effeminate society.
Well, now here we have what American culture standing in contrast to Victorian culture, where we use words like matriarchy, you use the term effeminacy, there was a kind of a delicacy and sensibility. Americans, on the other hand, some Americans were devoted to the idea of the manly virtues. Does that mean that realism was a male's game?
There is a masculine thread running through the fabric of realism throughout the 19th century, in part because men and women felt like they needed to create a literature and an art that was much more forceful and direct and unafraid to deal with everyday realities. They characterized the prevailing forms of fiction and art during the first half of the 19th century as being effete mm-hmm. and too dainty, mm-hmm. too unwilling to confront.
Books like Little Women, for example.
Well, although, here again, that's a particular work that sort of straddles two forms. Uh-huh. But many women writers in the early 19th century who dealt in a particular form of fiction, that is, one that self-consciously included a great deal of sentimentality, tears and funerals and stereotypical scenes in which maudlin emotions would be cultivated in the reader.
And then by contrast, you have Mark Twain coming along and making fun of, what's the little girl's name, Emmeline Grangerford?
Yes.
He just lampoons that whole business.
And he's using that character to satirize that form of feminine or sentimental fiction against which he and so many other realists were rebelling. In part, it was because of a fear that women were taking over the major channels of culture during the 19th century. That is, more and more women were becoming school teachers, they were directing Sunday school classes, they were becoming the primary purchasers of books and the primary patrons of the arts.
Uh-huh.
And the fear was that as women began to commandeer these modes of cultural expression, that sentimentality was simply going to be reinforced.
Well, two things occur to me, David Shine. Number one, we have writers like Willa Cather who come along and sort of set that whole stereotype on its ear. The other thing that occurs to me is that it is this very generation of women who were, how shall we put it crudely, taking over our cultural institutions, particularly things like education. These are the people who established very high standards and precedents for what we called public education in this country. We got a lot of contradictions at work here, don't we?
Well, there is a seeming conundrum at work when we say that women began more and more to dominate the literary and artistic marketplaces, and yet at the same time, realism was witnessing growing popularity. And one of the things I point out in the book is that the way to answer that puzzle is to realize that women then, just as women now, did not represent a monolithic abstraction.
Uh-huh.
That women were quite diverse in their taste and in their interest. Many women, instead of wanting literature or art to be a beguiling distraction from the everyday actualities of their lives, in fact, they wanted to read fiction and to look at art that dealt with recognizable scenes and incidents and characters. So women were represented in opposite camps during the 19th century, just as they are today. And yet this hormonal backlash, as I describe it, that helps propel the realistic movement, was a function of a variety of things happening in American society. That is, as more and more men, instead of being farmers, went off to work in the city, they left behind the women to take full control of the domestic tasks associated with raising the children, nurturing the children, and providing their moral and educational training. One of the fears about that process was that women would become overly involved in the training of sensibility and taste,
mm-hmm.
and overly sentimental in the process. And so realists were reacting against that in a very masculine way, both men and women. Willa Cather is a good example.
David Shine, again, your book is Facing Facts. It's an account of realism in American thought and culture. Did realism, in effect, run its course in the 19th century? What happened to it in the 20th century? There's a very large question for you.
Well, by the end of the 19th century, realism had come to dominate center stage of American cultural discussion and in terms of the literary and artistic worlds. But no sooner had it done so than it began to be displaced by a still new cultural program and outlook known as modernism.
Well, isn't this the fate of any sort of cultural movement? We have movement and counter-movement.
Exactly, although realism itself has not and will not die out completely. And none of these isms ever disappears completely.
Uh-huh.
It's really just a continual dialectic, if you will, between two basic forms of sensibility, realistic and representational versus idealistic and romantic and perhaps sensational. But it's certainly true that during the early 20th century, a variety of events and new ideas converged to call into question the basic notion of representational realism.
Well, the whole idea of objective reality, that there was something out there for us to think and feel and write about. Am I on the right track there?
Oh, precisely. As you and many of your listeners will know, it was in the early 20th century that physicists and psychologists began to question this notion of an external reality that was equally accessible to everyone and representational in art. A good example would be something that Gertrude Stein said early in the 20th century that one must never forget. She pointed out that the reality of the 20th century is quite different from the reality of the 19th century.
Well, in a way, what you're talking about, both at the beginning, the middle, and what appears to be the end of realism, is a way for people to define themselves in their political and cultural circumstances. America begins by trying to set itself apart from Europe, and then once it begins to walk on its own feet, you have these sort of contests going on within the culture of the country to figure out what it is culturally and politically. Realism, point, counterpoint here.
And I suppose that fundamentally what is at work is a perennial debate between what the primary purpose of art should be, whether it's art in the form of painting or art in the form of literature.
Well, let me stop you, David. How do you land on that? I mean, I take it you're arguing, therefore, that realism is very much alive. It's gone through any number of permutations.
Oh, but in fact, we're now witnessing a revival of what some people are calling neorealism in the 1990s. The essential debate is whether art should represent the world that we see and live within in a way that is universally recognizable to others, or should art primarily be a manifestation of the individual artist's imaginative power and creativity and sensibility?
Well, in a way, I don't want to stretch the envelope too far here, David, but what you are suggesting echoes the debates that we're going through in our educational circles, all the way the primary grades on up through the universities about the nature of what it means to be an American. We use words like multiculturalism, and what do we have in common? How do we, what is our access to what we call our common cultural values?
And 19th century realism was a very direct precursor of that notion of multiculturalism, to the extent that many self-consciously realistic writers, such as Howells, for example, wanted a realistic literature that would represent the diversity of American society, rather than continue to be a very narrowly focused expression of a particular class.
Well, that language sounds like it could have come from an educational debate in 1995 rather than at the end of the 19th century.
And that's what makes it so fascinating for me as a historian to study this topic, is the realization in the process of studying it that so many of the issues and the nuances and the subtleties associated with realism as a historical phenomenon still resonate with us today as we discuss debates about educational philosophy and purpose.
Well, now, David, we're running out of time, but I do want to leave a few minutes for you to reflect, given the nature of these comments you're making now, about not necessarily realism, but about the American educational enterprise. You are not only an historian and an observer of our culture, you happen to be the president of Furman University. I, again, will look at you sort of wide-eyed here. Do we have reason to be optimistic as we take the measure of education and the end of our century here?
Well, the landscape as I envision it is strewn with both obstacles and possibilities for higher education. On the one hand, the demography of our student populations that are going to be attending colleges and universities over the next decade and into the 21st century is changing dramatically. Obviously, so-called minority groups are now growing at a very fast rate and will come to represent a significant proportion of the demography of the college student population in the 21st century.
Does this make you, as an administrator and your colleagues on the faculty, does this make you nervous, or does this make you optimistic?
It makes me excited because I think there is a tremendous daily value in terms of the educational experience that college students have in the intermingling of students from different backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds, different races, different cultures. At Furman University, for example, we are very aggressively recruiting students from diverse backgrounds and from foreign countries as a means of helping educate our conventional American students in terms of their own backgrounds.
Well, David, let's conclude our conversation. Your book, again, is Facing Facts, Realism in American Thought and Culture, 1850 to 1920. I take it that this book and this theme still resonates very much for you and applies itself, finds a home in the 1990s. How is that? I'll give you a final word here.
Oh, it still does resonate not only with me, but with millions of Americans, as well as some of our very best writers and painters. John Updike, for example, remains, I think, one of our greatest writers and one of our greatest champions of a realistic point of view, in his recognition that to the extent that realism as a cultural movement has always embraced the desire to use the arts as a means of introducing a society to itself in all of its breadth and diversity.
And contradictions.
And contradictions and tensions and sometimes clashes.
Right.
To that extent, it will always be of great educational and moral significance to us as a nation.
David Shai is the author of Facing Facts, Realism in American Thought and Culture, 1850 to 1920. Facing Facts is available from Oxford University Press. David Shai is president of Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, information about where to write for a cassette tape of this program. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was David Shai of Furman University. Cassette tapes of this program are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 763. That's program number 763. The address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. We're interested in your comments and suggestions. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at uncecs.edu. Next week on Soundings, writer Roy Blunt Jr. He'll be here with readings and conversation about his new book, Roy Blunt's Book of Southern Humor. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Realism in American Culture and Politics, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a conversation featuring the president of Furman University. David Shai will be here to talk about Facing Facts, his new book about the realistic movement in American literature, art, and politics. From Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson through the end of World War I, realism was an expression of the varieties of American society. Facing Facts, an account of realism in American thought and culture, this week on Soundings.